KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Are Republicans in Congress really willing to let these cuts fall on our kids' schools and mental health care just to protect tax loopholes for corporate jet owners?
Frankly, I don't understand why everyone is so upset over eating horse. We don't feel guilty when we happily consume the rest of Noah's Ark. Is it because they're our friends in movies and TV shows? Well, I love bacon, so I just hope Spielberg never makes War Pig.
Stephen Colbert asking why we're so bothered about the thought of eating a horse. We're going to talk about horse meat scandal in Europe just ahead. Before that, President Obama talking about the sequester. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silliman. Steve Scher is away this week. The international horse meat scandal continues today. We've heard reports that the Swedish retail giant IKEA is pulling meatballs off the menu in stores in 20 countries. IKEA officials believe the meatballs may contain horse meat, but they say stores in the U.S. and Canada are not affected. European Union officials met yesterday to talk about tougher food labeling laws after the discovery of horse meat in a wide range of frozen food products. The scandal brings up a host of questions about everything from the safety of eating horse meat to the scope of distribution of mislabeled foods in general. And joining us to talk more about what's been happening is Marion Nessel. She's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She's written many books on food and nutrition, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, What to Eat and Why Calories Count, from Science to Politics. Marion Nessel, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Before we talk specifically about what's happening in Europe right now, I'm curious about eating horse meat in general. It's not totally taboo in Europe, so why are these recent revelations so disturbing?
Well, for people who don't like the idea of eating companion animals, they're just appalled by it. Also, if you follow Jewish dietary laws, they're not kosher. So the idea that horse meat has gotten into the food supply to the extent that it has in Europe is pretty upsetting on many grounds. But there are very, very severe cultural prohibitions against eating horses in some cultures. And we happen to be a culture in which roughly 80% of Americans say that they wouldn't and don't. We don't tend to eat things that we've given names to.
Is that different from prevailing attitudes in Western Europe?
Well, in some countries in Europe, horse meat has been eaten for a very long time, and horses are raised for food. And, you know, you could go to butcher shops in Italy and France and see horse heads and horse meat freely available. We just don't see that here.
In Europe, the horse meat would be labeled as such so that you would know that is what you're buying, correct?
Yes, absolutely. If they're selling horse meat, they're selling horse meat. And the Romanian horse meat slaughterhouse that sent out much of the horse meat that got into all these other products said, it's not our fault. We labeled it horse meat. We can't help what happens to it afterwards.
So when we talk about the difference between a horse butchery, some place that is selling something specific, and processed foods, part of the issue lies in the contents of a processed product itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fraud issue in Europe. The horse meat costs considerably less than beef. Mm. And if you can sell a product as beef at a beef price, but its ingredients are actually horse meat, you're going to make a lot of money off of it. And that's been the big driver of this.
Is horse meat less inherently safe than other processed meats that might find their way into a package of frozen lasagna?
Well, it wouldn't be a safety problem at all if it had been raised for food. But you don't know what these horses were used for. And the horse industry happens to be one, either in racing or in horses that are used for work. Those horses are treated with a lot of veterinary drugs. And those drugs should not be in the human food supply for a variety of reasons. They may not, there are arguments that they shouldn't be in horses either. Mm-hmm. Some of those drugs are legal, some of them are not. If there are residues in the meat, they could pose a safety hazard. The officials in Europe have said that the amounts are too low to be harmful to health. But at this point, I don't think anybody believes anything that anyone is saying about the food supply.
Now, I understand that the inspectors actually discovered the presence of the horse meat in these frozen foods a while ago and then retested everything to make sure that they were correct.
Well, they were so horrified by what they found and realized the implications of what they found that they did a lot of retesting and were to make sure that they were absolutely certain of what they found before they let the results came out. But what they found was that about a third of the products that they had tested using these DNA tests had contained horse meat, traces of horse meat DNA, and 85% of their samples contain pig meat. Hmm. Nobody's complaining about that, but that seems to me to be even more telling.
Because it was all labeled beef. Now, you mentioned DNA tests, but before I ask you about the tests themselves, how is it that they came to test this frozen food in general? Is that a standard practice in Europe?
Well, that's a complete mystery, and they've never said. And it's not clear whether they did the DNA testing because this is something that they're doing routinely. That's kind of amazing. It's the first time I've ever heard of that. Or whether they got a tip-off that there was horse meat in the beef supply and that somebody ought to take a look at it. But they tested frozen and refrigerated supposedly beef-containing meals, and that's where they came up with these surprising percentages. And the percentages were so high that this can't be something that was accidental contamination, like peanut contamination, where something is prepared in a factory where there are peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that. This has to be, as Felicity Lawrence, who's a food writer for The Guardian and who wrote a terrific discussion of all of this, her comment was, this is industrial-scale adulteration.
We're talking about the European horse meat scandal with food professor of nutrition and food studies, Marion Nessel. I know you mentioned DNA testing. Is this a new type of food testing that you can actually discern what type of animal gave its meat for food?
Yes, you can, and this is new. And what this tells me is this is a practice that has probably gone on for decades, but nobody could tell.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you get meat and you mix it in with hamburger, you can't tell where that meat came from. But the minute that DNA testing became widely available and possible to use, you can look for species, particular species of DNA in whatever it is you're looking for, and as soon as these tests became available, if they're being used, they're going to find it. I'm very curious to see whether anybody's doing any DNA testing in the United States.
Well, I was just going to ask you about that. The European Union food regulators met to talk about what kind of stiffer penalties or regulations or inspection practices they were going to put in, and that led me to wonder what we do on this side of the ocean.
If anybody's doing DNA testing here, I'm not aware of it, and they're certainly not talking about it. I mean, if I were a food company given this kind of crisis and I was selling a product that had meat in it, I would have full-page ads in all of the newspapers saying, we have done extensive DNA testing on our products, and we are selling 100% beef. And we'll be happy to show you the test results.
Well, this horse meat scandal reminds me a lot of the pink slime controversy that came up a few months ago. The bigger question, I guess, is how can we be sure what we are really eating when we buy processed foods, frozen foods?
Well, I think this is quite different from the pink slime business because that was an ingredient that's approved by the USDA. It wasn't listed on package labels, but it's not something that was fraudulent. The horse meat scandal is a case of food fraud. It's something that's cheaper being sold as something that's more expensive. It's classic food fraud with economic implications. And if we're going to be concerned about those kinds of things, and if these kinds of practices are widespread, and the European situation would indicate that it's quite widespread,
Yes.
Then it seems to me it behooves everybody to start testing.
Well, headlines on our side of the country, and probably in New York as well, lately have been about fish mislabeling.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same thing. Exactly the same thing. If you can take a cheap fish like tilapia and sell it as red snapper, you're golden.
So we're talking about fraud. I guess a question, and maybe this is my American sensibility, is whether if I'm buying a frozen lasagna made out of 55% horse meat, I don't know the exact percentages in some of these foods, am I putting my health at risk?
Well, I'm not aware that there are health problems about horse meat. In some ways, it's healthier. It has less saturated fat, more omega-3s. It may be better than beef. But it's not what people want to eat. And that is, and those cultural prohibitions are very strong. And it's not just a humane society concern. The humane society doesn't think that horses should be eaten or slaughtered at all under any circumstances. And they have promoted that agenda very successfully in the United States. But from a health standpoint, the only health issue that I'm aware of would be residual traces of veterinary drugs.
Right. So we're talking about a Europe-wide scandal, IKEA pulling its meatballs, but companies like IKEA and Nestle, which has also been implicated, are global corporations. So how is it that the distribution networks are confined to Europe? Do we have a different distribution system when we're importing foods from Europe?
Yeah, we do have a different distribution system, and Nestle says that none of its meat-containing products in the United States are sourced from any European suppliers. That's what they say.
I was going to ask you, is that...
That's what they say. unless somebody checks, how would you know? They say that European meat is not in any of their products. They source their meat from Australia, New Zealand, and other places. What we're doing now in the United States is shipping about 140,000 horses a year mm-hmm. to Canada or Mexico to be slaughtered. What happens to the meat there, we don't know. Much of it goes to Europe, we assume. Does any of it come back into the United States and get mixed into the hamburger supply? Who knows? Unless somebody's testing, we're not going to know.
So what kind of testing would you like to see in place when we're talking about either ground meat, raw ground meat, or processed foods that contain ground meats?
Well, I think if you're buying inexpensive ground meat, you're taking a risk anyway. I mean, we already know that that meat is going to come from sometimes hundreds of animals. Mix and the meat will be mixed together. I mean, that's been known for a very, very long time. And that's why, one of the reasons why inexpensive hamburger is a potential source of bacterial contamination or other kind of contamination is because there's so many different things mixed up in it. You know, if you want to have good hamburger that you're convinced isn't going to have horse meat in it, you go to a butcher and you have the butcher grind it. If you're worried about this, you become a vegetarian, or you buy kosher meat. Horses aren't kosher, so kosher slaughterhouses are doing everything they possibly can to keep any non-kosher animal out of that factory and that processing plant. If there's one clear winner in Europe from the horse meat scandal, it's kosher meat. The sales are booming.
I can't help but think of, you know, the 1920s where every home cook had a meat grinder attached to her kitchen counter or kitchen
exactly.
table.
You want a high-quality hamburger? That's what you do. You have the butcher grind it right in front of you. Say, I'll take that piece of meat. But we've become unaccustomed to that. We're not used to paying higher prices for hamburger. And this is a cost issue. Remember, all of this is about cost.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating. And no pun intended, definite food for thought. Marion Nestle, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
Marion Nestle is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She's written a number of books about food and nutrition, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and What to Eat. And you can read her online at foodpolitics.com. This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
9:19, Representative Denny Heck, Democrat, tells us what he thinks about the impending sequester in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Annie Wright Schools. The day school serves boys and girls in preschool through grade 8, while the upper school offers all-girls day and boarding programs for grades 9 through 12. Annie Wright is an international baccalaureate world school. More at a-w.org.
42 degrees and partly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says expect clouds through the day with an afternoon high of 48. Tonight, clouds, chance of rain, and a low of 40. I'm Bernard Willett. It's 9:20. Tuberculosis, HIV, and one woman's story of survival in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. The clock's ticking in Washington, D.C. as lawmakers scramble to reach agreement on a budget deal that would prevent the dreaded sequester. For some in Congress, the logjam's nothing new, but 10th District Representative Denny Hex witnessing the partisan squabbling with fresh eyes. He represents a brand new congressional district. He's a freshman congressman, and he joins us now. Hello. Thanks for taking time.
You're more than welcome.
Well, so first off, for listeners who maybe haven't heard about the sequester or are still confused, what exactly is set to happen on Friday?
On Friday, it begins the first day of $85 billion in reduction in federal expenditures that will take place between March 1st and October 1st. In real-world consequences, it means that our growth rate will be cut by about 25%. In a minimum of 750,000 people nationwide will be unemployed, some estimate up to $2 million. The sequester was a part of legislation enacted the summer before last, which was never intended to take effect. It was the poison pill. It was, as it were, the gun to the head of the super committee that would compel them to reach a more sensible long-term solution, one that wouldn't hurt the economy like this one will.
How specifically is this potential sequester going to affect us in Washington State, and more particularly your new district?
Well, in very real terms, the sequestration is frankly good news for polluters who are going to try and skirt environmental protections, but it's really bad news for folks who want to visit our national parks, who care about ecological protection, frankly. We're set to lose in Washington State more than $3 million that go to help ensuring clean air and water and preventing pollution, and $1 million for fish and wildlife protection. I visited often enough. Ohana Pakosh Visitor Center up at Mount Rainier will be closed. People won't be able to get there. Let's not forget that tourism is a powerfully important part of our state's economy. Something like 7.5 million visitors to our national parks in Washington State last year. And this is going to close that door. Might not lock it, but it's sure going to close it.
We're talking with 10th District Congressional Representative Denny Heck. What about the military? You represent Joint Base Lewis-McChord, I believe.
I absolutely do, Marcy. Thanks for asking. Let me put it this way. There is a small business located near Joint Base Lewis-McChord where they make equipment that go to service members in all branches. In fact, at this particular business, which is called Tactical Tailor, in all likelihood, the very equipment that SEAL Team 6 used when they went in to find Osama bin Laden was wearing their equipment. And as a result of sequestration, that manufacturing plant has already had to lay off about 50% of its employees, and they're at risk of more. In fact, about 10,000 civilian employees are going to have their pay cut by 20% between now and October 1st, unless somebody believes this is only going to affect high-income people who can somehow adjust for it. I was talking with the head of housing at Joint Base Lewis-McChord last week, and she said the majority of the dozens and dozens of people that will be affected in her shop make about $30,000 or less. This will ripple through the economy. It's good news for polluters. It's bad news for people going to parks. It's bad news for anybody who believes, as I do, we've simply got to grow this economy at a faster rate than we currently are in order to provide the traditional kinds of middle-class jobs that constitute the American dream.
Are these cuts going to take place immediately on March 1st if no agreement's reached?
No, I think they're going to be delayed somewhat, although some have already taken effect, as a matter of fact, such as the layoffs at businesses associated with Joint Base Lewis-McChord. For example, the unpaid furloughs that they talk about, there's a requirement that they be given 30 days notice. Mm-hmm. so they're going to be compressed over even shorter period of time. But we will begin to feel them, and already have, but even more significantly. I believe sequestration, which does not have to happen, which was never intended to happen, will push us perilously close in the South Puget Sound to something we could legitimately characterize as a recession.
So is there a main issue that is causing the impasse, or a couple of issues, or is it a myriad of things that you see are the sticking points?
Who would know, Marcy? Back here, everybody seems intent on blaming one another instead of sitting down at the table and working it out. You talked at the top of the interview about me looking at this from fresh eyes. Well, I got to tell you, I've been here 7 weeks. I've already got a weary heart. They're not sitting down going to work on this, despite the urging from many of us. Most of the newcomers, on frankly both political parties, have said, come on, people, get to work. Go in a room, lock the door. Come out when you have something that you can offer, in which there's a win for both sides. But don't let that which was never intended to occur.
Well,
we're going to kick 70,000 little kids off Head Start. Anybody who ever flies can look forward to a much longer line at SeaTac. This is not good. It was not intended, and it doesn't have to be.
If this was such a big problem, why did you have last week off?
Good point. I voted against adjourning the week before because I thought we ought to stay there, and many of us did. You're going to have to ask, frankly, the members of the majority party in the House why they chose to have it off. Many of us, I won't say most, or we would have stayed here, but many of us objected.
So you, as you mentioned, you are a freshman. You said that freshman representatives on both sides of the aisle are scratching your heads. You knew going in that Washington was polarized. I'm not even sure that's a strong enough word. So as somebody who is new, how much change can you affect in the culture of Congress?
That's a really good question, Marcy. I get asked it a lot. And I tell you what I say to people. I've got control over a couple of things. First of all, that I personally, as a member of Congress, never stop looking for common ground with the people with whom I disagree. Because the fact of the matter is, no matter how small of a toehold, if you can find common ground, you can build on it. And secondly, always, 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 and without fail, treat one another civilly. There's not enough of that in this environment, frankly.
We have, from Washington State, a delegation made up of both Republicans and Democrats. How often do you guys sit down together?
Well, we have not yet done it this year, which is not the same as saying that we don't have occasion to interact. I bumped into Congresswoman Herrera Butler at the airport on my way back here day before yesterday. This morning, I was at a meeting with Congresswoman McMorris Rodgers, both Republicans from Southwest Washington and Eastern Washington, respectively. And we always try to take the opportunity to, you know, explore with one another where we are on these things and where we can go forward positively.
So you mentioned that nobody has any idea what the major sticking points are because nobody's locked themselves in a room to talk. So what does that bode about the prospects of reaching any kind of agreement before midnight March 1st?
I think the chances are slim and none, and Slim just left the room. What I believe is the tiny ray of hope here is that as we approach yet another fiscal cliff on March 27th, when we come to the end of the continuing resolution, that's a fancy term which means the federal government runs out of authority to spend money to run federal government. Those of us old enough to remember the mid-90s remember when federal government was briefly shut down. We're going to do that again on March 28th if we don't reach agreement. And what I'm beginning to hear is that people are willing to fold into the continuing resolution debate considerations of walking back at least part of the sequestration, which I, again, want to say was never intended to be implemented. This was the poison pill. It's in our mouths. The glass of water is in our hand, and we're about to swallow it.
I know that you have work to do, Congressman Heck, but I just have to ask you, is this what you anticipated when you ran for office?
This is voluntary duty, Marcy. I do not have a right to complain, but I will tell you that it is a little bit more dysfunctional than I imagined, and I believed it was dysfunctional. Congress has a job approval rating of about 15%, And the truth is, I'm proud to be a member of it, and I work real hard every day for the people of the 10th District. But I'd like to meet those 15% who think that things are going fine.
What would you say to your constituents, because we broadcast right into that 10th Congressional District? What can the citizenry do to make any kind of change in Washington, D.C.?
I think the message needs to be loud and clear and uniform and repeated over and over and over. Sit down like adults and get to work on the problem.
Hey, just a last question about that sequestration. Does your pay get cut too?
You know, I have no idea. I will check. I'll have somebody get back to you.
Well, yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, if a lot of people are losing their jobs, perhaps everybody in federal government should be on a pay freeze as well until they come to the end of this debate.
Fair enough.
Denny Heck, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. Good luck out there.
Thank you very much. You have a good day, Marcy.
You too. Denny Heck is a Democrat. He represents Washington's new 10th Congressional District, which is in between Seattle and Olympia. The automatic federal budget cuts will kick in on Friday, March 1st, if Congress can't reach agreement. And as you just heard Congressman Heck say, chances are slim and none, and slim just walked out the room. This is KUOW.
It's 9:31. Tuberculosis, HIV, and one woman's story of survival in a minute.
Gifts of stock and other appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For information about how to make a gift of securities, contact Matt Albertson at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
Between after-school activities, homework, work, and commutes, there's lots of obstacles to families sitting down together.
Generally, what we do is, after the kids are asleep, if we can eat in front of the TV like that, which is kind of sad.
The changing tradition of the family dinner, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m. 43 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says we should hit 48 this afternoon, and we're expecting the day to wind up mostly cloudy. 9:32, I'm Bernard Ouellette. This is Pope Benedict's last week on the job. What's he doing this week and what happens next? We'll find out in 35 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherr this week. Tuberculosis killed almost 1.5 million people around the world in 2011, but believe it or not, that's down 41% from 10 years earlier. Despite new drug therapies and scientific research, TB and HIV are still global epidemics. Louisa Makukula knows the problems firsthand. She was diagnosed with both diseases in 2001. This native of Zambia not only survived, but she's now a health activist. Louisa Makukula joins us in the studio, and I'm going to push this microphone closer to your mouth. Welcome to Seattle.
Okay. Whoops.
I need you to roll your chair over. I wondered if you could first tell us about when you first got sick.
I got sick in 2002. I was married. I lost my husband, whom I stayed with for 13 years. Immediately after his death, I started getting sick with persistent fevers. And then I suffered from tuberculosis. And I was also diagnosed HIV positive in 2002.
Did you know initially what was wrong with you?
No, I didn't know. Because I was in and out of the hospital. I did not know because at that time I had no knowledge of TB, neither HIV.
So is that what your husband died of as well?
Yes, we only realized that he died from the same after his death.
Oh.
Because all the symptoms were seen, yes.
So you got very ill. Where did you go?
I went to the hospital, and then they had to take an X-ray to confirm, because I used to have fevers, all the symptoms of TB.
Mm-hmm.
So after getting that x-ray, they could not even do the sputum smear, mm-hmm. because just from the x-ray, they realized that I had TB.
They could tell that from a chest x-ray.
Yes, exactly.
What about diagnosing the HIV?
Oh, that one was done after they checked my TB, and then they tested me for CD4 count, which was very low. It was at 50. Then because of that, that's when they went ahead and checked for my HIV test.
You had young children at that time?
Yes, I had two children, and they were very young.
So what happened to them while you went to the hospital?
The children were being taken care of by my parents at the time I was in the hospital.
We're talking with Louisa Makukula, who was diagnosed in 2002 with tuberculosis and HIV. She was in her native country of Zambia at that time. How close were you to a hospital?
Oh, it was not very far to the hospital. Though at the time I was diagnosed with TB and HIV, I was hospitalized for 4 months. Because at that time I was very sick. I was like paralyzed. I was on a wheelchair for that period. I couldn't walk.
Wow.
I was not working. So they kept me in the hospital. That put me in an isolation ward. You know, there are certain diseases that when you are sick, they put you in an isolation ward so that you cannot infect others.
Right.
But at the time I was in the hospital, you know, as a health facility, they're supposed to explain to a patient why they are putting you in an isolation ward. But it was not done to me. I was there alone in a room, and, you know, I felt so stigmatized. I said, but why am I being put in an isolation ward alone? Does it mean I'm finished, I'm dying, or what? You know, a lot of things could go through my mind.
Right.
You know, which was not fair. And then they could tell all my relatives that this person don't share the plates or spoons, whatever she uses, should be only be used by herself alone, without really saying the reasons why it's supposed to be like that.
So 4 months you were in isolation?
Yes, I was.
When, at what point did they start giving you drug medication?
They started giving me drugs while in the hospital. And at that time, drugs were being bought. And I'm thankful to my family, which were very, very supportive to me. They used to contribute resources, and then they were buying my medicine. And in Zambian currency, it was about 1.5 million, which is almost equivalent to $200 per month.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were in isolation, you felt stigmatized, but we have read in this country that tuberculosis and HIV are very widespread in African countries. Is that true in Zambia as well?
Yes, it is. And in fact, to date, TB, HIV is a number one killer, to say.
The number one killer.
Yes, especially to people who are HIV positive.
So is it both men and women who are affected?
Yes. Even children? Even children are affected.
HIV as well?
Yes.
How are they contracting these diseases?
You know, there are some who are born like that. They get it from their mothers.
Right.
Yes.
Hmm. In 2002, when you were first diagnosed, how much public knowledge was there about these diseases?
Oh, there wasn't much public knowledge at that time. And that's why we lost a lot of lives during that period.
Hmm.
You cannot be compared to this time when people have knowledge.
Well, I was just going to ask you, how much in that decade has education increased and sort of just telling the population how you might get these diseases and perhaps how to prevent infections.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like efforts are better, or at least there's more widespread activity. That's something that you're involved in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the cost of the drugs. $200 a month It's your family who paid for this for you?
$200 equivalent to that question. Yes, it was my family members. I had very good support from them.
But not everybody has that kind of money.
No. That's why I was saying that we lost a lot of lives because people could not afford. Look at somebody, a vulnerable person, could not afford to pay. They might commence on a drug, maybe only manages to take it for a month. Thereafter, they fail to raise resources to continue with the medication.
How long did you have to stay on the drugs?
Oh, for the TB drug, I took it for 9 months because of my CD4 count, which was very low. So it took time for me to respond to the treatment. So it was, instead of taking it for 8 months, because that time we used to take it for 8 months, I was given another extra month for them to make sure that the TB has cleared. But for now, I'm still on ARVs, which is for life.
Right, yeah. Right. And still $200 a month? It must be more.
No, you know, we are thankful to the Global Fund, you know.
Who helped pay for the cost of the drug.
You know, the Global Fund, the people of Zambia, particularly those living with TB, HIV, and malaria, are highly indebted to the Global Fund, without which I and other Zambians would not be alive today. It is because of the Global Fund that people living with HIV, TB, and malaria are able to access drugs this time. And I have witnessed some of the facilities back home which closed due to lack of funding,
right.
You know, yes. And we ended up having people dying, you know. Mm-hmm.
When you talk about healthcare facilities, the Global Fund has been around for about 10 years, I think, at this point in time. How much does the Zambian government contribute to either building public health facilities or doing education campaigns?
Mm-hmm. Well, the government is contributing, especially that now they've introduced free drugs at the hospitals, which was not the case. And like I was saying, when I started taking the treatment, I only managed to buy for 4 months.
Sure, it's expensive.
And then fortunately, in the fifth month, with the help of the Global Fund, our Zambian government, through the Ministry of Health, introduced free treatment, which has really helped.
Do you have any idea what percent of the Zambian population is infected with malaria, TB, or HIV?
Okay, I wouldn't know exactly the percentage, but it's quite on a higher rate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are we talking a third of the population, maybe? Half the population?
About that
much?
Yeah, because there are a lot of people on treatments.
And that is similar in other African nations as well, isn't it? That we're talking about pretty high infection rates for these diseases. Mm-hmm. So essentially the need is education, healthcare facilities, and for malaria and tuberculosis, those are curable diseases.
Yes.
HIV at this point is not.
It's not. Once you're on drug, it's for life.
Wow.
But you can prevent TB. And it's curable. Yes.
So you're clear.
I'm cleared now on TV.
So you were in this isolation ward for months. At what point were you allowed to go back to your family?
Oh, it was after 3 months. That's when I went to join the family home. And it was not easy, my dear.
No?
It wasn't.
You were still ill, weren't you?
But, you know, I'm thankful. When you have a will to live, there's nothing impossible.
Well, you've written a blog post about being at this point where everything in your mind was just dark. It was your bleakest point.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what is it that gave you that will? Because some people don't have it.
Oh, you know what gave me the will to live was my children. You know, each time I looked at my children, I thought to myself, I said, now, if I give up, who's going to take care of my children? I was like a mother, a father. I was everything to them. And that really gave me the will to live.
We're talking with Zambian health activist now, Louisa Makukula. So you now, that is what you do now. You do help other people.
Exactly.
And their children. What exactly do you do?
You know, when I got better, I managed to set up a support group. And that support group, I started with a 20-member group. We used to call it TUSO. You know, TUSO means help in English. TUSO, it's our Zambian language, yes, but in English it means help. It was comprising of men and women living with HIV, and most of whom were TB survivors. We worked in the communities to follow up with patients who were on TB and to monitor them, to ensure that they completed their medication. And at the time, we had 500 clients.
Wow.
Yes, who successfully completed treatment. And we are thanks to Global Fund.
Were you trained in healthcare before you started?
Yes, we were trained. You know, we had to have basic training just to have a little knowledge that as we go out in communities, we should know what to tell the people. Yes.
Before you were sick, though, this isn't what you did.
Before I was sick, no, I was not doing this. I only started doing this after I got sick, because that time I was all right. I was able to work. I was energetic. I could do anything on my own. But the time I got sick, then that's when I had that passion now to help others out there in the communities.
What is the biggest need, do you think, when you go out into smaller communities?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that people who are sick need the most?
Nutrition.
Ah.
Yes. Because, you know, when you're that the drugs are very, very strong, and you cannot take them on an empty stomach. You need food, you know, and that is the biggest challenge that we have. Yes.
So you were mentioning Global Fund. Global Fund helps with building healthcare facilities, helps with drugs. Does it also help with nutrition, or is that something that other organizations need to step in and help with?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You need help from everybody.
Yes, we need help from everybody.
In terms of Zambia in particular, are there extra challenges when it comes to fighting diseases like TB and HIV?
Yes, we have some challenges, because you find that some people have barriers. They stay very far from health facilities. Mm. And that is the biggest problem that we have. Because you find that somebody maybe would take a distance of maybe 200 kilometers to get to the health facility. And it's not easy for someone to continue. You'd find that, you are due to go and collect your medicine, but because of the distance, you just give up. And then you end up developing drug resistance. Ooh. Because of no continuation of the medication.
Right. I also wondered, you mentioned feeling stigmatized when you were in the hospital. Is it still a stigma in Zambia to be diagnosed with HIV?
Well, it is still there, because, you know, the two diseases are attached to the stigma. So it's still there. It's not, I cannot really say it's completely done away. No, the stigma is still there.
So in addition to distance and that social stigma, what would you most like to see change in your company, in your country, when it comes to treatment of these diseases?
What I would like to see change is maybe the health facilities should be taken nearer to the people.
So community health facilities.
Yes, exactly. They should take the services nearer to the people so that we can reduce on the mortality rates. Yeah.
In terms of public education, I don't know a lot about the literacy rates, but what are the biggest challenges to getting people to do things like eat well, or if they can get all of their medications, to continue to take them until, well, forever if you have HIV? I mean, what are the biggest challenges? Is it literacy? Is it fear? What are you up against?
Well, I think both comes in. Fear and literacy, they both come in.
Mm-hmm. So is that, you know, I know you work with Global Fund, but is that something that the Zambian government needs to address, fear, public education, or just education in general?
Well, the government has to educate. We need to have awareness, you know.
Do you get a sense that the Zambian government wants to do that?
Yes, 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 they do.
So for you personally, you've been doing this work for quite a long time now.
I can say I started in 2004.
So almost 10 years.
Yeah, sure.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And for you personally, in addition to, I mean, you're very energetic and optimistic, but what do you get out of doing this work personally?
In this work?
Yeah. What does it bring to you personally?
Come again.
How does, why do you continue to do this work?
Why I continue doing this work? It's because of the passion I have. Yes. I don't like this time to see people dying. When a disease can be curable, it can be prevented. We have free access to treatment this time. So it wouldn't feel good to see people dying. You know, that time it was different when people didn't have the knowledge and treatment was expensive. But we are thankful now that we can access free treatment.
Louisa Makukula is a TB and HIV survivor. She's from Zambia. She's a health activist in her home country. She's traveling in the United States right now in support of the Global Health Fund. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Weekday. I'm not sure what it's like outside at this moment, but I know that there's snow in the mountains. And today we talk with Michael Fagan about playing near Mount Rainier. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Marcia. How are you?
I'm good. So you want us to go out and snowshoe or ski today, eh?
That's right. And actually, some unexpected sprinkles have showed up in a few spots this morning, but nothing to get overly concerned about. Our trip today, as you mentioned, is near Mount Rainier Park. It's not quite in the park. It's the Carbon River entrance, Coplay Lake, mm-hmm. which is basically you drive on the road that goes to the trailhead to Summit Lake, although with the snow you can't drive all the way to Summit Lake. And you drive to the snow line, which is close to 2,600 feet, 2,700 feet or so, and pull off on the side. And this road's not gated, and during the weekend you might run into a few trucks, but it's certainly not a heavy used road by any means. Snowshoeing was best in the sense that with some of the tracks from the trucks, it would make it a little difficult to ski. But this is a nice trip. As far as views, today and Wednesday afternoon would probably be the best in terms of visibility and the chance of snow showers. For our trip, it was 2.5 miles one way, so that's...
That's quite nice.
Yeah, it's quite reasonable, 1,000-foot gain, so you're not getting into some marathon scenario.
That could kill you on snowshoes.
Right, it's a lot harder to work. Now, if you're wanting something more macho, if you will, you look at Green Trails Map 237, and you could look at Surprise Lake or Mount Baldy on there if you're looking for a little bit more exercise.
I think 2.5 miles one way sounds good to me, Michael. You mentioned a few sprinkles. That's down in the lowlands. Is that showing up near the entrance to Mount Rainier Park as snow?
Right. The snow line is, and, you know, if you are going out today or Wednesday, it's going to be best because you will have snow showers if there's any precipitation, because temperature is about 32 degrees at the lake. Hmm. Now, it does warm up Thursday and Friday, so you'll probably be getting some rain there.
Ooh. It seems to me, as we approach the 1st of March, that this is really sort of the in like a lion kind of weather.
Yeah, that's what the saying goes, although the amount of rain we've been getting and the rain for that's coming in, well, we have some light rain coming in tonight and early Wednesday and then Thursday and Friday. It's not looking heavy. In fact, we're quite a bit below normal. Normal rainfall for February in the city is 3.5 inches, and so far we're only at 1 inch. So we're quite a bit behind, and there's no way we're going to catch up. So some of the precipitation moving in will be light. In the weekend, it's too early to tell which day is going to be the nicer in terms of sun, but I think one of the days will certainly be dry. So there's hope if you want views, or if you really can get off today or tomorrow, those will be nice days.
Because it sounds like from what you're saying that we need to go do this hike before it gets warmer.
Right, because it's certainly not a lot of fun snowshoeing or skiing in the rain. In fact, in the city, it's supposed to warm up quite a bit on Friday, mid to upper 50s, so that's certainly going to mean some wet, sloppy snow in the mountains. So try to get off of work today.
All right, I'm going to run out right now, Michael.
Okay, I'm right behind you. Trust me.
Michael Fagan is with the West Coast Weather LLC, and his blog Fagan's Weather World suggests good hikes to match the forecast. You can find out more about this hike and other places at hikewashington.net. Thanks so much.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye. And now, the sound of the day. It's a little marching music. No, it sounds like marching music. It sounds like drums. It's actually a pot of water that's warming up on a wood stove. The stovetop is so warped that the pot is shaking, causing it to perform a little drum solo with sizzling water droplets dripping from the lid, acting as cymbals. Let's listen to a little bit more of that. Yeah, it does make you want to dance. We thank our weekday listener, Paul in Redmond, for sending in the sound of water warming up on a wood stove. And that, as always, prompts us to ask you what interesting sounds you hear. And then we would love it if you record 30 seconds and send those sounds to us along with the story behind them. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. Bernard likes that so much he's dancing to it in the other room. Sounds pretty good. Oh, good. Yeah, it does. Very rhythmic, isn't it? So that's our sound of the day today. And send us what you're hearing. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to hear from Jamie Manson about Pope Benedict's last week on the job, last few days on the job. Tomorrow is his last public audience. We're also going to hear from photojournalist Nick Dunlop, who has gone and traveled among the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And this is Tuesday, and it is sort of spring-like. Our gardening panel is back with us. And if you've got questions for them, why don't you email them right now, weekday@kuow.org, or get ready to call 206-543-KUOW. You can always listen to archived weekday segments at our website. That address is kuow.org.
9:59. Good news for the housing market, according to a report out today. Specifics in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Obstetrics. The UW Medicine Obstetrics program helps women have healthy pregnancies and healthy babies through its comprehensive family-based approach, including midwifery, lactation support, genetic counseling, or high-risk care. More information at uwmedicine.org/obstetrics.
44 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 48. It's partly to mostly cloudy at the moment. Forecast says expect it to wind up mostly cloudy. Overnight cloud.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.